Hi, I'm Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. At the end of last week, Governor Phil Scott announced small but significant changes to the state's ban on multi-household gatherings. It had previously been announced that fully vaccinated adults could meet up with one another and could meet up with one unvaccinated individual or household. But now, an unvaccinated individual or household can meet up with another unvaccinated individual or household at any given time. The governor specifically mentioned children's playdates as one positive outcome of this policy change. And restaurants will also be able to seat up to six people at a table now without having to ask if they're all from the same household. But cases of COVID-19 continue to remain high in the state compared to last spring and summer. And with state officials pushing to get as many Vermont schools as possible fully open by the end of April break, there's a lot of chatter about whether it's too soon to relax any of these gathering rules. Today on the show, we'll talk about the new guidelines and get your health questions answered by Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan. Deputy Commissioner, thanks for joining us again.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Let's just dive right into questions, Deputy Commissioner, and we can move through some of the updates as we answer listener questions and as we go through the various topics that people are asking about. Abby LS tweets us, "I'm a Vermont breastfeeding mom, and Pfizer has the most data behind it for breastfeeding. I'd like to find Pfizer and advocate for other breastfeeding people to be able to choose, hoping the state will support me too." There was talk today during the press briefing about the fact that, you know, for Vermonters who are age 16 and 17 and are only eligible to get the Pfizer vaccine because the others haven't been approved for people that young, they can call the state hotline and find a place that has the Pfizer vaccine. And we've previously heard that teachers and school staff and early childhood educators will have some options when it comes to determining whether they would participate in a state vaccine clinic that was expected to have the Johnson & Johnson vaccine or one of the other clinics that is more likely to have one of the two-dose vaccines. That's all gotten a little bit fouled up by the fact that the state doesn't have as much Johnson & Johnson vaccine as it had initially expected to. Nonetheless, I think Abby's question is, how can people who have a legitimate concern about which vaccine they're taking find a way to be able to have some choice in the matter?
No, it's a great question. And normally we would advocate for people to, you know, have as much information as they can and be able to choose. Our challenge in this case is that our vaccine is so limited and the supply to one given location isn't necessarily stable. Each week we find out from the feds how much vaccine we get and how much of each kind of vaccine we get. And so it really becomes difficult to then plan to send one type of vaccine to a location week after week when that may change the inventory. And so what we need to do is to really be allowed to have as much flexibility as we can so that we can maximize vaccine uptake, which means we need to fill all those slots regardless of vaccine. I do understand the concerns. However, we are confident that both Pfizer and Moderna, along with the Johnson vaccine, are all safe for breastfeeding moms. You know, we have really talked to CDC. Our immunization team is regularly on calls with the CDC around any updates or any new information coming out. I recognize that people do some of their own research, but we really do trust the research and the guidelines coming out of CDC and recommend that the best vaccine right now among these three is the vaccine that's available for you.
And so, you know, while saying all of these vaccines are safe, you're also saying people don't have a choice in which vaccine they take at this point.
They really don't, unless they choose not to get vaccinated at all. And then it's possible later that there will be more choice when we have less demand and more vaccine available. But we just can't be certain of that. And our highest priority is to get people vaccinated now. The only real choice piece, and that's not so much about choice, it's by necessity, is really the Pfizer for the younger people, because that's the one that's been approved for 16 and over. So we do need to move the younger people toward that, which is another example of why we don't want to be encouraging people to pick and choose, because there are cases where we don't have the choice at the state level. Young people, 16, 17 years old, really do need to take the Pfizer. So we really need to be able to have the option to move them toward that and not have, for example, those clinics fill up faster because people have a preference. We really do feel confidence in the safety of all. And so we're really trying to promote the use of whatever's available, recognizing that that is sometimes frustrating for people who want to be able to make their own selections based on some of the research they're doing.
Last week when you and I spoke, there had been a moment in a previous press briefing where the governor said that those who had religious objections to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine would not be required to take it and would be put on, quote, a list to be able to get a different vaccine dose. Do you have any updated information on that? Because he didn't go into any detail on that, and it was nothing that I've heard about in any other state policy briefings.
I have not heard more about that. I do know that if somebody can't take the Johnson, and that's what's provided. And again, the Johnson isn't widely available for folks. So for most people who are calling in, they really do have access to Pfizer and Moderna. So I would have to look more into that, but I'm not aware of more information on that.
Let's go to Ginny calling in from Mount Holly. Hi, Ginny. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just looking for a clarification. 2 weeks after I've had the second shot, where I supposedly have built up immunity, can I still be a carrier, even though I probably would be asymptomatic?
Thanks for the call, Ginny.
Yeah, thank you very much. So 2 weeks after you've had the vaccine, if you don't have symptoms and you haven't had a positive COVID test, you may still have the virus if you had picked it up earlier, but it's unlikely. We would say at this point, if you've had the vaccine, it's been 2 weeks. It sounds like you weren't already positive that you know of before the vaccine. So it's unlikely. Again, you know, nothing's 100%. So is it possible that you could be carrying the virus due to an interaction with a positive case? It's possible. However, for the most part, we would say you do not have the virus, and so you're not carrying the virus based on our best information.
And that has been evolving information as more people have gotten these vaccinations, right? Because at the beginning, there was a lot of caution around what vaccinated individuals should assume, because even if they were unlikely to get the virus and have symptomatic cases of the virus, it was unclear whether they could still transmit the virus to others. And the state seems to be relying on information that says that is has a very low likelihood of happening.
Yeah, and I think we were very cautious at the beginning, and some of that caution may have been heard as the idea that if you get this vaccine, you will still get the virus, but maybe you won't become sick. The caution really was we weren't sure of the extent of the protection in terms of transmission. We knew it was very likely that you'd be protected against transmitting, but we didn't know the extent. So we really took a more cautious approach. However, it really is bearing out in the way that we had hoped and that we had hoped for and intended based on the research, that it is unlikely that once you're vaccinated, very low likelihood that you would contract the virus and that you would be able to pass it on.
Let's talk a little bit about updated guidance for multi-household gatherings. The governor did announce last week that two unvaccinated households or individuals could get together at any given time. You don't have to have only one other unvaccinated household that you gather with at all, but you can only do, you know, two unvaccinated households at a time. And this is an update for many people that will be welcome, but others are very concerned about, you know, what this means for the possibility of transmitting the virus to others. Karen in White River Junction has a question and says, I'm wondering whether, when indicating two unvaccinated families can gather indoors, Governor Scott means folks to be masked. We were cautioned that that should only happen if there are no at-risk individuals in the group. But I don't see any way to tell whether someone that is unvaccinated is at risk, since COVID-19 has surprised some who had no apparent risk factors and became long haulers after being infected. And what about young children? Karen says it's hard to find data on what their situation is with respect to long-term effects.
When the governor talks about this, and we actually spoke about this in a meeting this morning with Dr. Levine in another meeting, when we say be aware of those who are high risk, it's really based on your best information. So if you know that in the other family, someone has heart disease or someone has diabetes or has another risk condition and is unvaccinated, then that might not be the right household for you to be spending time with. And so that's really the awareness. It's based on your best information. In terms of masking, we would still encourage masking if two unvaccinated households get together in social distancing. Obviously, if you're having a meal together, you won't be able to mask, but we'd certainly encourage you to spread out. And this is really around having lower rates in the state overall. So this is about small gatherings, really just two households, which reduces your risk, ideally with no one that's high risk, to the best of your knowledge, and masking and social distancing where you're able to do that.
For vaccinated individuals, whether they're gathering with others who are vaccinated or unvaccinated, do those same guidelines apply that even vaccinated individuals should, wherever possible, in private spaces, continue to distance and wear masks?
No, I believe we've said if you are vaccinated, there is sufficient protection, and particularly if you're getting together with other vaccinated people, those people can be without masks and they don't have to worry about the spacing. And that's really, that's the benefit of getting vaccinated, that you are allowed to have a little more freedom. You're certainly much, much more protected as a result of the vaccination. And so you don't need to mask and distance again in that household environment with another vaccinated family. If you're out in public, of course, please continue to follow all of the usual guidance.
Jody in Burlington wrote in to say, as Governor Scott, quote, turns the spigot, there are some nuanced behaviors that he and Dr. Levine might not address. And Jody says, I see, for example, doctor's offices without magazines. Is it okay to bring them back? Stores with closed-off dressing rooms, can they reopen them? People playing indoor pickleball with masks on, even though they're on the other side of the court from each other, can we take them off during play and put them on when we are within 6 feet of others? I'm sure there are many other small things. It would be great if they could address these behaviors that may be a bit outdated as we open up. I'm not sure you can address each of those individually. They're very specific, but I think to Jody's larger point, there are so many different scenarios that I think people start to feel like fall under a gray area where they either want to know, can I do this and get away with it? Or is it safe for me to do this thing? And how should I assess the risk of all of these different scenarios?
Yeah, that's a great question. If you're unvaccinated and you're out in public, we still have COVID in this state. And as we can see through some of our outbreaks, it's still very transmissible. And it's still making people sick. We're certainly seeing the death rate go down. So continue to use caution. I think that was one of the takeaways from a meeting with colleges that we had this morning. Dr. Levine said, let's continue to preach caution. There are some loosening, but if you haven't heard about that specific example, then err on the side of caution. We are working very quickly to update guidance because every time there's a change in the executive order, there's a lot of other guidance to be updated, and we may not always get to it. So err on the side of caution. Use your common sense where possible. Well, it's always possible to use your common sense, but where the guidance isn't clear, take the principle of what you're hearing and then apply it to your situation and make your best judgment.
Let's go to Martha in Burlington. Hi, Martha. Go ahead.
Yes, hi Jane. Thank you for taking my call. I was on my way up the Grand Isle yesterday, and I took Exit 17. And there's a sign that says, "If you're coming from out of state," I think I'm not. I'm paraphrasing it, but that you should isolate, quarantine. And it made me think, with other states loosening or, getting, like doing away with their COVID-19 restrictions. Is anyone concerned, like the governor and the, legislators, people, about that and how, especially during tourism season, people could be coming from a state that has no restrictions? I was just wondering if anybody's looked at that.
So, Martha, just let me ask for further clarification on, what you're sort of pinpointing as your concern. It's that other states may have looser guidelines, more opening up, and so you're worried that people could be then coming to Vermont infected, even if Vermont has stricter guidelines?
Yes, actually. Yes.
Okay, so what do you think, Deputy Commissioner?
So I'm a little unclear on the question, but if the question is, if people are coming in, should they still quarantine? Yes, they should. Are we concerned that we have
unless they've vaccinated, right? There's no requirement to quarantine upon coming into Vermont if you are fully vaccinated.
Right. And I wasn't, sorry. So I think I may have missed the clarification on her question. Yes, if they've vaccinated, they can come on in. If they haven't vaccinated, they should quarantine. And I might be missing a subtlety in the question. If you might want to restate, Jane, what she might be getting at.
Well, Martha, let me ask you to restate, because, you know, there are these rules about people having to quarantine before coming to Vermont if they're not, you know, under those eligible conditions. But are you worried they're going to be breaking the rules and coming here and coming with a possible infection?
Exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, Deputy Commissioner, if other places are loosening up, and there could be, you know, a rise in cases in these places, or people who are more at risk of getting the virus because they're taking fewer precautions than they were before. And then they come to Vermont and aren't following our rules, but have come from loosened up places. Should we be worried about that?
We're in a really delicate time right now where vaccine is ramping up. So you do have increased protection across the country. And at the same time, as a result of that, some policies are loosening. So we're in this very tricky middle spot where there really is an opening for us to continue to have some transmission, continue to be somewhat vulnerable to additional cases while at the same time ramping up vaccination. So I think your caller makes a great point. We're almost in this middle spot. Earlier on, it was just so clear based on the rising rates that, you know, if you're traveling, there's some really clear rules around it. Now we're in this middle spot, not just with travel, but with a lot of things where we're sort of, you know, we've got one foot on each side of the fence, which is why we're really asking people to err on the side of caution. And so all I can say is we hope that people can continue to stick with the measures and recognizing that people coming into the state also, that they continue to quarantine where necessary, or if they're vaccinated, obviously they wouldn't need to do that.
Let's go to Terry in East Montpelier. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I have a question about transmission of the virus by people who are vaccinated. It seems we don't apparently know whether people who have been vaccinated can transmit COVID, but it seems like that would be pretty basic science. You take 50,000 people who've been vaccinated and 50,000 people who have not, and you test either with nose swabs or something else, and you find out. And I wonder why those data have not been either done or released. It seems like that information would be very useful and valuable for both the vaccinated and unvaccinated populations.
Deputy Commissioner, what do we know about, I mean, we've talked about this before, even earlier today in this hour, but to Terry's point, what do we know about the possibility of those who have been vaccinated transmitting the virus to others?
Sure. Prior to now, the earliest studies at minimum showed us whether or not people would become sick, would become hospitalized, or would die. And that was our highest priority, particularly hospitalization and death. Longer studies were required to tell us now, given that, are people transmitting? And so those are the studies that are going on now. And those are the results that I talked about earlier, that we've already seen results of some large scale studies that show very little transmission. But that is ongoing. These are very new vaccines. A lot of the technology has been around for a while, but these particular vaccines are new. So we are kind of learning as we go on the transmission. We already know about the safety and efficacy of the vaccine. We, in terms of both safety and efficacy in terms of preventing hospitalization and death, the part that we were less certain about was transmission. We're becoming much more certain about that now, that in most cases, you don't transmit the virus once you're vaccinated, but there is some transmission. And I don't have the numbers in front of me on that, but the data so far is going in a really good direction. So we're no longer in the place where we would say, we don't know if you can transmit. Now we'd say, unlikely that you would transmit.
We're getting answers from Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan. And UN in Bakersfield says, I've not heard anyone mention when or under what conditions hospitals might allow visitors to non-COVID wards or to patients. Who controls that decision? Must all patients continue to suffer alone without family or personal caregiver support and regardless of their being fully vaccinated? Deputy Commissioner?
Yeah, that guidance is actually getting reviewed this week. There have been some recommendations coming in from hospitals around possible changes in the way hospital staff gather, the visitation policies. And so the policy team is reviewing that and reviewing it also with our epidemiological team. in order to make sure that we have a policy that's as friendly to people as possible, recognizing the isolation and the effects of that, but also still cautious, again, in this middle period where we're ramping up vaccine, but recognizing that we're still very much capable of having outbreaks. And so that guidance is being worked on. I'm hopeful that we have some finalization on that, hopefully next week.
We have a question from a listener who says, I live in a community where there are a number of adults who are not planning to ever take a vaccine. When I am fully vaccinated, will I need to use additional caution around these people?
That's a great question. When you're fully vaccinated and you are just with another household, if they're unvaccinated, you do not need to mask or distance. However, when you're out in the public, you need to. Longer term, eventually when we have hopefully most of the state vaccinated, we'll probably reach a kind of community immunity that even if you are around people who are unvaccinated, those people will be fewer and we will have much less virus. And so it's unlikely you would need to take mitigation measures then. But for now, generally, we're saying mask and distance regardless, except in cases where you're really in a household environment. And then if you're fully vaccinated with other vaccinated people, you're fine, or even with one other family that's unvaccinated.
Well, I think Jillian has a question that sort of picks up from that advice, and Jillian's calling in from Essex Junction. Go right ahead.
I'm just wondering, because I heard you say multiple times that vaccinated people don't spread the virus, yet for some reason we're still being told we have to wear our masks, and to me that doesn't make any logical sense.
Yeah, so why is it that out in public, vaccinated individuals have to wear masks if we're also being told that they are unlikely to transmit the virus?
They are unlikely to transmit the virus. However, there is still a small likelihood, and we have enough unvaccinated people that that risk increases a little. Once that risk goes down considerably, then we're in a better place. But right now, and again, this is also in accordance with CDC guidance, we're in that middle area where we're asking people to do things that we may not ask them to do in a couple of months. But for now, still recognizing that out in public, you'll have a lot of people unvaccinated. So it will increase the chances that you come into contact with the virus. Again, unlikely that you would become infected with it, but there is some likelihood and a higher likelihood when you're around more people. But in a household environment, that likelihood is significantly reduced.
Presumably in a household environment, you're also sharing an acknowledgement of the risk level that you're willing to take with those people.
You are, yeah. And again, you know, it's going to be based on your own kind of personal decision-making in a household environment, but we see a significantly decreased risk. It's really about, you remember early on when we talked about keeping your circle small, it's that type of idea. So early on, you kept your circle pretty small, and it was that sense of your known or trusted neighbors. In this case, out in public, it's just simply a higher risk, not a very high risk, but it is a higher risk. And so we want to be able to protect you and really continue that norm of masking, because most people haven't. So we want to keep up that norm as long as we can until we need to, we're able to change it.
It's interesting, though, too, because when we take a step back and we talk about health policy for a whole population, in this case, we're thinking about the state of Vermont. Some of health policy is based on the science of, in this case, transmission. But some of it is also based on human behavior and fairness and what you think people will follow or not follow. There are a lot of factors. And I wonder how much of this policy of requiring vaccinated individuals to continue wearing masks out in public may also be impacted by the idea that it would feel like an unfair advantage to those who are not vaccinated, that they don't get something, and then maybe there would be less compliance among the general population of unvaccinated individuals. In other words, you know, how much does human nature and sort of a sense of fairness play into population-based policy?
Yeah, I would say the primary driver on most policies is public health. However, some of it, for me, less about fairness and more about ease of being able to understand, implement, and comply with a policy. So when we're talking, for example, about colleges, you know, most young people on a college campus have not been vaccinated. There are probably some who have. However, right now we're telling colleges, when you're getting together, you know, in your smaller groups, assume everyone's unvaccinated because there's actually so few who are. So it's easier to implement a policy that applies in that way. It becomes difficult to tailor a policy. That's not the primary reason. The primary reason on most of these policies is the public health science, but there is that aspect of what is easy for people to understand and not so confusing. And so I would say the combination of that sometimes comes into play, particularly in these transitional times.
In Burlington, Lynn is on the phone with us. Lynn, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Thank you. I'm very confused about loosening some restrictions when only 1/4 of the population is vaccinated. It's not like anything has really changed. So why is the guidance being loosened for some things that just doesn't make sense to me?
Deputy Commissioner?
Yeah, there are two reasons. One of them is the vaccine. So we've got up to 27% people vaccinated. Actually, there's three reasons. One of them is the vaccination rate, 27%. That's moving it up. The second is that those who were most likely and who are most likely to become very sick or die, that pool is reducing. Those who are most likely to become very sick or hospitalized or pass away are the elderly and those with high-risk conditions. We're really increasing our vaccination among that group. And so the vulnerability goes down a little bit. And the third reason, and a very important reason, is that our positivity rate is down. We're down to 1.3% positivity rate. So we know that there's less virus circulating in the community. It doesn't mean it's not there still. We need to be cautious. But if you're in a small group, you are less likely, simply based on the numbers, to be in touch with someone with the virus at such a low positivity rate. If you're in a large group, the chances are higher because the numbers are higher. So we're kind of moving back to, in some ways, that time early in the pandemic where we still said, you can get together, keep your group small. So that's where we are now based on the positivity rate, the number of people vaccinated, and the kind of protection that we are already in now for some of the most vulnerable or those who could become hospitalized.
Well, CJ has a similar question in some ways, but phrases it more in terms of case numbers and says, why is 100 new cases per day okay now when such a rate would have resulted in a stay home, stay safe order earlier in the pandemic? In addition to the fact that you've said that one of the questions is not just how many cases are there, but how many people who are more likely to have a really bad reaction to the virus are vaccinated. But CJ points out, with long-haul COVID and the problem of new variants from mutation, why not strive for zero?
Well, we are striving for zero. I don't know that we'll ever get to zero, because this might be here to stay. So we might always have smaller numbers of cases. What we would like to, in addition to striving for zero, we'd like to get to a place where if you do become sick with COVID, it results in illness that isn't so serious. And we're not in that position now, of course. We'd like to get to the place where the populations who become infected, for the most part, are protected, and ideally the whole population. So striving for zero is a great place to be. But 100 is not, I guess I should say, it's not okay to have 100 cases. We're also recognizing, though, that the difference between now and then is that we have hope on the horizon with this vaccine. 100 cases several months ago with no vaccine on the horizon was a scarier place to be. It's still obviously a real concern, and we still do have some deaths, and we still do have hospitalizations and illness. However, we know that within a couple of months, we're going to have a significantly different population in terms of protection. So again, in that middle spot. But I agree that, you know, this is no time to throw caution to the wind. We are just doing this very carefully. And there's a lot of other parts at play, of course. We want people as much as possible to move away from the isolation and to do that as safely as we can. So we're balancing a variety of needs.
Marsha writes in to say, my son and his family are living in Kenya, where there is very little availability of the COVID vaccine. If they come to visit in the summer, will they be able to get vaccinated here, assuming that by then all Vermonters who want to will have received the vaccine already?
That's a great question. Right now, you have to be a Vermont resident to get vaccinated, and a lot of that is about limited vaccine allocation. I don't know what the situation will be in the summer, and if someone is here for a long-term period in the summer and there's enough vaccination, there could be a different different policy, but for now, and for the near future, you continue to have to be a Vermont resident. Or to be working in one of the eligible categories.
Maggie's with us from Stowe. Maggie, what's your question?
Hi, I'm calling from Stowe. I'm just curious if there's going to be any change in regulations around small offices reopening. I know the recommendation is to work from home, but I'm curious if that's going to change anytime soon. And I can take my response offline.
Deputy Commissioner?
Yeah, we've had a lot of questions about telework. The overall recommendation has been to telework. Some small offices have continued to remain open because they're able to distance. Again, this probably goes along with our movement toward greater vaccination. As our vaccination moves up, these are the kinds of policies that we'll look at. But for now, there's no change in that. But there's certainly a lot of questions coming in, and we anticipate in the future that we will put out different guidance around telework. Some people may choose to continue to telework for a variety of reasons, but I know that people are eager to get back together, and that's something we're looking at. Again, the next 8 weeks, we should see a really different environment in terms of vaccination.
Darlene's with us from North Springfield. Hi, Darlene. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have severe rheumatoid arthritis, and I'm really long overdue for getting infusion to help me with my pain and inflammation. And my doctor is telling me that I have to wait 4 weeks till my second shot. So if I could get the Johnson & Johnson, I'd elect to get the vaccine now. But is it possible to know where they're giving that so I could sign up to get the vaccine at one of those locations? I hate having to choose between, you know, living in pain all the time and getting vaccinated for this deadly virus.
Yeah, thanks, Darlene. What do you think, Deputy Commissioner?
Yeah, what we're hoping to do, and we're looking at it now, is to be able to at least identify clinics that let you know whether or not it's Pfizer, Moderna, or a one dose. And if there are people in your situation for whom it doesn't make sense to, you know, get vaccinated right now and to wait, you may choose to do that. We don't have a great answer right now, but we're hoping to at least name those clinics so that you know if it's a two-dose or a one-dose. And we know doctors are providing some advice and trying to manage this on your end. I know it's challenging to manage it on our end. When we have so little vaccine, it's tricky right now. So I think the best advice I can give is, if you're able to, you should be able to know when you sign up. It will let you know that a second dose is coming, and that will tell you if you've signed up for a two-dose vaccine. But at this time, Johnson is not widely available outside of populations like teachers, for example. And again, that was about getting an influx of Johnson and Johnson vaccines so that we were able to do that additional population. So no great answers now, but hopefully in the next couple of months that might change.
Yeah, and Darlene, I'm sorry to hear about the situation you're going through. It sounds like a really tough decision to have to be in a position to make, you know, sort of certainly good to be able to get the vaccine, but a no-win situation in terms of trying to figure out when and how to deal with your pain. So I sympathize. Camilla is calling in from Brattleboro. Go right ahead, Camilla.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Anyway, I have a question about the dosage of the vaccine and the safety of it for people who already have health problems. I'm 69. I don't have a doctor. I don't have health insurance. Managed to keep myself relatively healthy. But if I go and get a vaccine, I am worried about blood clots. I have a history of blood clots. You know, have various other problems. And also, I'm 69. I weigh 95 pounds. Are they going to give me the same dose that they would give to a 300-pound man? So I do have concerns about getting the vaccine. I'm not a COVID denier, and I've been careful, but
yeah, Camilla, I hear you. And there's several different threads we could pull on there. But to Camilla's last question, is the dose the same for somebody who weighs 95 pounds as it would be for someone who weighs three times that?
Yeah, the dose is the same for everyone. Camilla, I think you have some great questions there. Overall, all of these vaccines are safe. They're just as safe for you at 95 pounds as they would be for someone at 300 pounds. These are very, the doses are actually very small, and vaccines can be very powerful with a small dose. And so you would receive one dose and then two doses. Again, the side effects are pretty limited. Some people do have some side effects. The issue with blood clots, that has come up as a question around AstraZeneca, although the research shows that there doesn't appear to be a higher rate of blood clots among AstraZeneca. However, we don't even have that vaccine in Vermont. So the three vaccines that we have in Vermont right now,
or in the anywhere which, in the United States right now, AstraZeneca has not been approved in the U.S.
It's not approved. Yeah, it's not approved. So if you're hearing about that, and when you say blood clots, I wondered if you were hearing about that. That's not an issue here. These are really safe vaccines. We're feeling very confident. Our own deputy, our own commissioner, Dr. Levine, has been vaccinated. Many of the government officials have been vaccinated. And so I would ask that you, as much as you can, have confidence in these vaccines. And again, side effects are relatively minimal. We're not seeing many side effects either. However, becoming sick with COVID can make you very ill. And so there is a real benefit to getting vaccinated.
And just to close the loop on a couple of other things, at 69, Camilla is eligible to get the vaccine now, and you are not required to have a primary care physician or health insurance in order to get the vaccine, and you will not have to pay for it.
That's right. You won't have to pay for it. You don't have to provide any information about insurance, and you don't need a primary care provider. You can simply go onto our website, or you can call 1-855-722-7878, and Camilla, they will find you an appointment if you call now and let them know your situation.
We heard earlier today in the governor's press briefing that on Friday, the expectation is that he will be able to lay out a full plan for getting every eligible adult vaccinated or eligible for to register for a vaccine by the end of April. So more information on exactly what that rollout is going to look like should be forthcoming on Friday. In the meantime, we're fielding your questions on already eligible people, on how the vaccine rollout is going, questions and concerns you have about side effects of the vaccines. We were just talking, Deputy Commissioner, about concerns about blood clots that have been coming up in relation to the AstraZeneca vaccine, which, again, has not yet been approved for use in the United States. So this is not a vaccine that is being administered here, but people are probably reading about some of the issues and some European countries putting a hold on using the AstraZeneca vaccine. What we have heard today and from other health leaders around the country and around the world is that they're not seeing an increased rate of blood clots related to the AstraZeneca vaccine as compared to the normal rate of clotting in the general population. But Dell in Worcester is wondering then why we're hearing about this. Dell says, regarding the question about the AstraZeneca vaccine and incidence of blood clots, if 30 cases of blood clots related to about 5 million doses is a quote-unquote normal rate of such incidence in the population at large, have there been reports of comparable incidents associated with the large number of other vaccines that have now been administered to the general public? If so, why hasn't anybody pointed this out? In other words, why are we only hearing about this with AstraZeneca?
That's a great question. I'm not certain why it's coming up with AstraZeneca. It's possibly someone, sometimes after a vaccine, one might notice that a population seems healthier because they are not contracting a particular illness. However, they may still continue to have other health effects. And so I was doing a little reading that indicated that perhaps, things become more apparent and sometimes people can draw incorrect ties between. So after you get a vaccination, you still might become ill with the kinds of things you would have become ill with whether or not you got the vaccination. And sometimes people can start to see that as causal. I don't know why the blood clots have been highlighted in this way, because the actual data shows that among the vaccinated folks, it's the same or even possibly a little lower coming out of the AstraZeneca. So I don't know if somebody picked up on it and started running with it and it took off as a story and now people are having to clarify that, or what happened there. But you will continue to get the kinds of things that you might normally get after a vaccination, and it doesn't mean it's associated with the vaccination. So a few weeks later, you may develop some kind of condition that you may have developed anyway. And so that's where it does get difficult, because of course, we're all a little more sensitive after we get vaccinated to what's happening with our bodies. And it's easy to make those ties. But in most cases, those ties are not actually related to the vaccine, as those studies have shown.
We have a listener question who writes in, who will vaccinate the inmates in Mississippi? And these are inmates who've been convicted of crimes in Vermont, but who serve part or all of their sentences at a prison in Mississippi right now.
Yeah, so if we have inmates in other states, those inmates would likely be vaccinated by the health program of that institution. And so normally they have contracted health vendors, a healthcare partner, or perhaps they are connected with the hospital. So it's however that correctional system normally delivers their healthcare. Likely it would be that way, but I can't be certain of who's actually delivering the vaccination. It would depend on how Mississippi set it up. It's unlikely we'd be doing it differently for our inmates.
We have been looking at updated information about the outbreak at Northern State Correctional Facility in Newport, and we heard from Rachel Feldman, who is a spokesperson for the Department of Corrections, just today, that the most up-to-date numbers are 165 unique cases among incarcerated individuals and 13 cases among staff that have been detected through facility testing, as well as a handful who tested positive through outside testing. So that's about 180 cases associated with this outbreak, and no movement on policy regarding inmate vaccination priority. What is the perspective? What conversations are happening in the health department right now around this outbreak and the responsibility of the state to protect and care for inmates who are under the care of the state?
Yeah, the 180 cases is overall. The number, most of those have been medically cleared and resolved. So the actual current number of cases is about 37 inmates and 6 staff.
That's right.
Yeah.
But the total in the outbreak is about 180.
That's right. Yeah, you're correct. Yeah. I just wanted to clarify for listeners the difference between total cases and active cases. We recognize it's a really important issue. And one of the big priorities was to vaccinate all of the staff, that being the most protective thing we can do around the inmates. And of course, any inmate who qualifies under a category is getting vaccinated. So anyone right now who is 65 plus or who is 16 and over with a chronic condition, which is disproportionately higher usually among corrections inmates, are also offered vaccination. But we have not determined that there is a priority to vaccinate all of the inmates. We recognize that states are all handling that differently. We're looking at our vaccine allocation. We're looking at what we know about hospitalization and illness and death. And we are, doing our best to stick to our priorities, which is really around the elderly and those at highest risk with medical conditions.
How much of the conversation is around what you think the public palatability would be for prioritizing inmates and a bias against prioritizing people who are incarcerated?
You know, I can mostly speak to the conversations we have from a public health perspective within the health department. And so our focus really is around risk and where we think the greatest risk is and how disease is transmitted and through which avenues. And so I know that we recognize that the staff who come and go, having them protected is one of the most protective things we can do. But I can't really speak to the effect of public backlash or public interest. I think that, we do our best to avoid hospitalization and death, and that has been our primary driver. We got a lot of pushback right from the beginning on almost every approach we've taken, even though there's been support. You know, every time you choose a population, you don't choose another population, and it becomes very difficult because everyone's important, and there are a lot of competing priorities, and we recognize that. And these decisions are hard. And I know people are worried about their relatives and their loved ones, including those in the correction system. So I recognize it's hard and painful and that people worry. And we're trying to stack up all those worries and all of the science and all of the risk against a pretty minimal amount of vaccine right now and make the best decisions we can.
Where does the investigation stand into whether distancing policies were not being followed or whether there was something in place that wasn't working at Northern State for that level of viral spread within the population who are incarcerated there?
I do know that it was primarily contained to one unit of the facility, which makes me think that broadly, the staff were able to implement kind of an isolation procedure. I can't speak to what was happening within that unit and where that investigation is. I think corrections might be better able to speak to that.
Yeah, and we'll follow up with them. Do you know how many units there are? Because a couple weeks ago when this was first coming out, Rachel Feldman told me that there were about 345 people who were inmates at that facility. And now with about 180, 165 inmates total who have gotten it, that's a lot of that population.
It is. And I know that we're doing, we're testing the entire facility again on Monday. And so we're continuing to track this very closely. We have an outbreak team that's dedicated to it and assisting corrections in trying to keep it contained.
Andrew tweets us, there's very limited information on the BIPOC COVID vaccine initiative. Is calling Burlington's Resource and Recovery Center the only option to find out about clinics, even for folks living in southern Vermont?
Yeah, great question. Thank you. So we are just rolling out the BIPOC multi-generational household clinics, and those are clinics for people who do not choose to sign up through our usual clinics, but who may want to sign up who are eligible, so either 65 plus, 16 and over with a high-risk condition, a member of the BIPOC community, Black, Indigenous, people of color in Vermont, who want their households tested. We are rolling that out now.
Vaccinated, not tested.
To get vaccinated, I'm sorry, to get vaccinated. Our first clinic will be on the 20th here in Burlington. We should have information up on our website probably by the end of the day, but that first clinic will be happening in Burlington. We also have clinics for migrant farm workers happening this week as well in Middlebury. We also have a clinic starting up in Brattleboro next week. So as these are rolling out, you'll be able to go to our vaccination page. There is a section that speaks to these BIPOC household clinics, and we'll have more information there. Then you'll be able to call the number for that region, and that is the registration partner who has better connections to the community, and they'll be able to register you for those clinics. Our vaccine is limited, so we anticipate demand might be higher than our ability to serve all the needs, but we're working on trying to ramp that up.
And again, the website to go to is healthvermont.gov/myvaccine.
Yes, and I don't know if the information is there today. It may either be end of the day or tomorrow.
And for those who struggle with reading English or who don't have access to the internet, is there a place that they can call to get information on that, on the BIPOC initiative?
Yeah, right now, if you call our call center, they may not have the details. This is just rolling out now. But if you call tomorrow, they should have more detail at 1-855-722-7878. Or on our website, and again, if you don't have access to the website, we'll have the number for the local contact. But by tomorrow, I believe our call center will also have the number for the local contact that you can reach out to.
Tracy Dolan is a Deputy Health Commissioner for the state of Vermont. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jane. And thanks for all Vermonters for continuing to vaccinate and to wear masks and spread out. I know it's hard, but we're in the last few months of this, hopefully, and I appreciate everyone's cooperation.